It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we saw Democrats clash over health care in last night's debate. Which candidates' plans do what? We'll talk to a health journalist to sort everything out. First, here's someone who found herself a little out of her depth preparing a well-known dish.
Welcome to the French Chef. I'm Julia Child. What do you do when you have only a moment's notice and you've got unexpected company? Well, one of the great things to do is lasagna. And this is lasagna à la française, which means in the French manner. And I should add that it should be also called à la française aux USA, meaning in the United States, because I'm not a little tiny French woman, though I may look so, I am not.
Despite some struggles, the French chef persevered and prevailed, though it may have taken her a little longer than just a moment's notice. Today on Food Friday, our guest has lasagna recipes for all of us, from classics to unique twists and variations. Anna Heasel is senior editor at Taste, an online cooking magazine, and she's author with the editors of Taste of the new cookbook, Lasagna, a baked pasta cookbook. Anna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Well, you write that that moment we just heard, there was kind of a pivotal moment in lasagna. We've come a long way in American recognition of the cooking of lasagna, right?
We sure have. I'm so happy that we got to listen to that clip together. That video of Julia Child making lasagna is one of my favorite video clips ever. I love that she has fun with it. She laughs. She kind of talks about lasagna a la française as if it's like something that everyone knows about and has heard of. I like there's a moment where she boils the noodles and then sort of drapes them around a colander, as many of us would, to sort of cool them down and dry them off, and refers to them as a spaghetti laundry. Love that.
Now, in your cookbook, you cover a lot of ground, from, you know, what we might think of as a classic lasagna to, you know, crazy space-age lasagnas all over the place. It's really versatile, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, Julia, her lasagna a la française might not be at the top of my list to cook today, but she's onto something when she says that it's fun. It's something that you can put together with leftovers if you have an incredible bolognese or ragu in your fridge from last night. It can be sort of like a fun impromptu thing.
Now, what I love about lasagna type dishes is they look fancy when they come out. They take some cooking skill, but not too much for somebody like me. You don't need super fancy ingredients. It's something that really any of us can probably get a handle on.
It's so true. Yeah. I mean, before ricotta was readily available all over the United States, a lot of people in the U.S. made it with cottage cheese, and a lot of people still do. Cottage cheese, cream cheese, cheddar, kind of like whatever you could find in your local grocery store. And it still is pretty versatile. Most grocery stores today have ricotta, they have mozzarella, they have lasagna noodles. But you can still really have fun with it and experiment as much as you want.
Now, you cover different kinds of noodle options, and you just mentioned the store-bought, which is, you know, the dried noodles, which a lot of us will use. People can make their own if they want to get really fancy. I'm seeing in stores, and you talk about this in the book, and I'm a little frightened of this, the no-boil lasagna noodles. What's up with those?
Yeah, I was a little bit skeptical at first, I have to say. But they actually work really well. They turn out a little bit more thin and delicate than your standard pre-boil noodles. So you get really nice thin layers and you don't have to cook them beforehand. I would say one of the things I really like about the traditional kind that you boil is that nice kind of chewy al dente texture. It's a little bit hard to replicate with the no-boil noodles.
And there, you give a warning, the no-boil noodles have to be in contact with something liquidy in the pan, right?
Yeah, that's right. They have to be totally covered in sauce in order to cook. They just need that little bit of moisture.
We are talking about lasagna with Anna Heasel from Taste. Her new cookbook is Lasagna, a Baked Pasta Cookbook. Anna, let's talk about a classic lasagna tomato sauce. You've got different options in your book, but what's the key to a really good crowd pleaser?
Really good crowd pleaser. There are a few options. We have a classic tomato sauce in the book, which you can use in anything from stuffed shells to baked ziti to any number of lasagnas. There are a few awesome meat sauces, too. The bolognese is really awesome. I also love making sort of a traditional Sunday gravy. The one in the book has Italian sausage and pork shoulder and also meatballs. So it's kind of like this amazing trio of meaty flavors infusing that tomato sauce.
You shared a few recipes with us today. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. I want to take a peek at them. Porchetta spiced pork shoulder lasagna is one of them. This, you know, you've got everything from vegan to extra meaty. This is one of the meat ones. Talk about this particular recipe.
This one is one of my favorite recipes in the book. Every time I've made it, people have just gone crazy for it. You basically take a whole pork shoulder and you braise it with lots of fennel seed, crushed red pepper, some fresh rosemary, and it just becomes this beautiful, spicy, salty, garlicky sort of pull-apart meat. And then you work that into a tomato sauce and build your lasagna with layers of this beautiful pork shoulder, tomato sauce, and ricotta. It's so good. I highly recommend it.
And this is when we're cooking the pork first, and then it gets into the assembly of the lasagna. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's always great if you have a chance to make the sauce the day before, just because the more time you have to simmer it, the more flavor develops. And then it's just one less step you have to worry about, like, in the couple hours before people come over for dinner.
And that reminds me, Anna, I think most foods, you know, oh, leftovers, okay, that's cool. They're not quite as good as the first time around. Lasagna is like the Benjamin Button leftover, right? It gets better as it ages, it seems like.
I agree with that so much. I was going to say, even as a leftover slice, it looks as fancy as you would have at a restaurant. It has these beautiful structured layers. It sort of comes together a little bit. A little bit of the pasta pulls in some of the moisture from the ricotta and sauce. It is such a good leftover. I've eaten it cold for breakfast, honestly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't blame you.
I've microwaved it at the office. If you reheat it in the oven, it gets a little crispy on top again. Any of these. I really love leftover lasagna.
I want to check out another recipe, and this one was kind of a mind-blowing one for me, but I want to try it. A spinach ricotta lasagna, but hold on, slow cooker spinach ricotta lasagna. We can make lasagna in our slow cookers?
Yes, you can. And this is another way that you can avoid boiling the noodles beforehand if you just don't have space in your kitchen for the spaghetti laundry, as Julia called it. You just put the dry noodles into the slow cooker with all of the other layers, and then you turn it on for a few hours, and it does its thing. It's great.
Does it take extra water or extra moisture in it to make sure those dry noodles get cooked, or just does the natural moisture from all the other stuff do the job?
Yeah, there's a little more moisture accounted for in the recipe just to make sure that those noodles absorb the liquid that they need to.
And can we, and you've got this particular slow cooker one is with spinach and ricotta. Can we try other recipes and just add more moisture and it might come out okay in the slow cooker?
I would definitely suggest trying it. I think you want to make sure that each of the noodles is fully submerged and fully covered with sauce, sort of like when you use the no-boil noodles. But I'd encourage you to try it. Let me know how it goes, too.
We're talking to Anna Heasel, Senior Editor of Taste. Her new cookbook with some of the other editors there is called Lasagna. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to cook lasagna? What tips or suggestions or favorite recipes do you want to share? Do you have questions about how to make lasagna or a better lasagna? Or do you have another pasta dish you like to bake? There are other lasagna-adjacent recipes in the cookbook. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can pull a few recipes for the weekend over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Anna Heasel, lead author of the book Lasagna, a Baked Pasta Cookbook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make lasagna? Have you experimented and put your own twist on the dish? What memories do you have of making or maybe eating this classic dish? Is it emotional support food for you? Or do you have a question about how to make it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Patrick is with us in Milwaukee. Patrick, hi.
Hello there. How are you?
What do you want to tell us about Patrick?
So I'm heavy on quite a few things from the garden, specifically right now, tons of squash and zucchini. I just tuned in, so I may have missed a question about this, but I wanted to use my Instant Pot to make some type of vegetable lasagna with garden surplus things, and I didn't want to look it up online.
Well, great. I'm glad you caught us, Patrick. That's perfect. So let's take that one step at a time. Anna, you definitely have some advice for using zucchini and even winter squash in our lasagna or lasagna-like dishes.
Yeah, that's right. I have not made lasagna in an Instant Pot, but I love that idea. And also, I respect the fact that you don't want to look up directions. I've been there, definitely. Yeah, end of summer veggies. There's a recipe for a sort of eggplant parm lasagna in the book that sort of channels all of the delicious, cheesy things that we love about eggplant parm with a lasagna. There's a summer veggie lasagna that has zucchini or summer squash or whatever you can find. And then autumn squash, there's a recipe that includes sage leaves and little cubes of squash. It's great.
Yeah, some oven-roasted squash, right, in that one?
Yeah, that's right. I have not tried it in the Instant Pot, though. I really want to hear about this, though. If you try it, you have to let us know how it goes.
Yes, Patrick. Make that Instant Pot recipe over the weekend and let us know how it turned out. Well, one recipe you didn't share with us, but like, so I'll say this is the hit in the office looking at the picture. I'm probably going to end up making this one. Carbonara lasagna. And it's got fried eggs cracked over the top of it, and it looks awesome. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, this one is so cool. I mean, so when you think about it, carbonara has so many breakfast elements. There's like a carby starchy element. There are eggs. There's some kind of pancetta or bacon element. So it's great in pasta form, and it's great as a breakfast lasagna. And the way we kind of worked it out, because obviously you bake a lasagna, but the great thing about the eggs in carbonara is that you get the creamy yolk texture sort of coating the pasta. So the way we did this is you actually kind of cut four little holes, little round holes in the lasagna as it's finishing baking. And you crack those eggs into it, kind of like you're making an egg in the hole. Have you ever done that with toast?
I've made like a French toast permutation kind of like that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you just crack them right in there and then you finish baking with the eggs and you just bake it as like long enough until the whites actually turn white and the yolk is still a little bit soft and creamy.
That looks fantastic. We are talking about making lasagna on Food Friday. Anna Heasel is with us, author of the book Lasagna, A Baked Pasta Cookbook. Well, I want to get to one more recipe that you did share, and it's up at WPR.org/Food Friday. This looks good. Fried lasagna bites.
Yeah, I love this one. This is by Chef Mark Ladner, who was the chef at a restaurant called Pasta Flyer. He worked at Del Posto for many years. And this is a dish that he served at Pasta Flyer. He describes it to me as kind of wanting to eat a candy bar version of lasagna or almost like a granola bar version of lasagna. So he spent hours and hours of testing, like how do you turn lasagna into something that you can hold in your hands because it's saucy and unwieldy usually. And he discovered that if you refrigerate it, it sort of firms up a little bit. It has a little more structure. And then you can cut it into little cubes. And then once you have little cubes, you can freeze them and roll them in flour. And then they sort of build this little flour membrane, kind of like a little chicken finger or something. And so through this process, you kind of get sort of like those little pizza bites that everyone used to eat in college from the freezer section of
the
grocery store.
Oh, like pizza rolls. Yeah, my kids still
demolish those.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're like crispy on the outside and really like gooey and saucy on the inside. Yeah, those fried lasagna bites are really cool.
That sounds fantastic. So we've frozen them in the flour, and then when we pull them out of the freezer, that's when we fry them?
Yeah, well, so basically his process is a couple times freezing, pulling out, and rolling in flour to build up this little floury wall. So it's a little bit of a process, but once you have them ready to go in the freezer, you can pull them out whenever you want. Like, if you have an impromptu party and you want to really impress your guests, you can pull a bag of them out, fry them up, serve them with some delicious Negronis.
Now, that reminds me, by the way, Julia Child in that setup we heard from her, she said this is a great meal to make for last-minute guests. That seems wrong, right? Lasagna requires some kind of premeditation.
You know, it's funny. I usually think of it as a project. I mean, often for having guests. I love to make a lasagna for guests. But we usually think of it as a little bit of a process. Like,
right.
You make a slow simmered sauce for a while and then build it into a lasagna. But she's kind of on to something. I really like the idea of making impulse lasagna, and I've done this many times, kind of like using whatever's in the freezer. And so I think if you have like a well-stocked freezer, you have like a few, you know, Tupperwares of sauce in there ready to go, you can kind of make it impromptu. And there's actually a recipe in the book using frozen ravioli. So you kind of skip the whole layering ricotta between pasta step. You layer frozen ravioli between sauce and mozzarella and throw it in the oven, and the whole thing takes about a half an hour. So that I would totally make if last-minute guests were coming over.
That's reasonable. Still time for your calls, by the way, at 800-642-1234 if you make premeditated lasagna or impulse lasagna. Join us at 800-642-1234. This is interesting. There's a kind of a dessert section in your lasagna book. What?
Yeah, there is. So one of the craziest recipes in the book is for this Nutella lasagna that's topped with this toasted, creamy hazelnut marshmallow coating. And this comes from a taste writer named Allison Robicelli, who used to have a bakery in Bay Ridge in Brooklyn. And she made this Nutella lasagna kind of as a joke. She kind of was trying to troll her customers a little bit and make this kind of funny stunt food item. But the joke's on her because it totally caught on. People loved it. People lined up around the block for it. So her bakery eventually closed. She stopped making it, swore she would never make it again. But I begged her to let me include the recipe in the book because I love that story and I love the recipe too.
Well, let's go back to our callers now. Scott is with us in La Crosse. Scott, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about, Scott?
So I came up with a recipe for a venison lasagna with spinach and bacon and toasted pine nuts.
Wow.
Ooh, tell me more.
Just to die for. So I start off cooking the bacon first, because venison's so lean that you kind of got to add some fat to it. And then I will, after the venison's all cooked, or the bacon's all cooked, I'll set it aside and I'll cook the venison with some mushrooms. And then I'll wilt some spinach and I'll put the bacon and the venison and mushrooms in the sauce with the wilted spinach. And then I'll toast some pine nuts and put it in there. And then I'll use that for the sauce that I layer up with the noodles and the cheeses.
Fantastic. Wow, you had me at venison,
so
bacon,
cool.
Pine nuts, spinach, and mushrooms. That sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Scott. Let's bring in another caller. Sue is with us in Woodruff. Sue, hi.
Hi. I am an old Italian lady and make my traditional lasagna. And now my adult children are both gluten-free and dairy-free, as are their partners. And I'm getting a little stumped at how to change my traditional recipes to have them over for dinner.
Wow. Okay, there's a challenge, Anna. Gluten-free and dairy-free lasagna. Any thoughts?
That is. There's actually, so this is like a little bit on the outside parameters of what we might think of as lasagna, but there's a great recipe in the book by Chef Michael Solomonov of Zahav in Philadelphia for a moussaka. And the moussaka is totally dairy-free and it's noodle-free because you kind of roast these wide, thin layers of eggplants. And you layer it with this beautiful, fragrant sauce that has a lot of cumin, a little bit of cinnamon in it. And to me, it feels like eating a lasagna because there's that warmth from it. There's the really fragrant, meaty sauce, but without, kind of surprisingly, without any pasta or any dairy.
That sounds fantastic. I hope that helps. That's a great substitute. Somebody at the office was saying they'd heard of people doing a similar thing, but with sliced zucchini instead of the eggplant there. I guess that could work, too, especially with zucchini disposal.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much of it at this time of the year. It's great for that.
Now, Anna, I got to ask, you and your colleagues at Taste have been making and presumably eating lasagna for a long time now in the lead up to this book. Is it possible to get lasagna'd out?
Oh, man. You know what? there were a couple of weeks after I filed the manuscript when I just could not eat lasagna or look at it. But sort of unsurprisingly, because I love lasagna, probably after about a month, I just came back to it and wanted to make it all the time again.
Fantastic. Anna, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Anna Hiesel, senior editor of Taste Online Cooking Magazine. We've been talking about the book. She's the lead author, Lasagna, a Baked Pasta Cookbook. We've got three recipes that Anna shared with us over at WPR.org/Food Friday, the porchetta spiced pork shoulder lasagna, fried lasagna bites, and the slow cooker spinach ricotta lasagna. Check them out. Make them this weekend. Coming up after the news, healthcare was a hot topic at last night's Democratic debate. We'll talk about some of the back and forth and what candidates' different plans could look like in action. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the newest Ken Burns documentary explores more than 100 years of country music. One of the historians featured in the series lives here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to him about the film and why country music has been such an important part of his life. First, the leading Democratic candidates met for another in a series of debates last night. Healthcare policy was one of the big topics with some serious differences among the candidates. Here's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, then former Vice President Joe Biden.
On Medicare for All, costs are going to go up for wealthier individuals and costs are going to go up for giant corporations. But for hardworking families across this country, costs are going to go down.
And if you notice, nobody's yet said how much it's going to cost the taxpayer.
We heard a lot of references to the Affordable Care Act, making changes to it, eliminating private insurance and keeping a public option. Julie Rovner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of KHN's What the Health podcast. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it seems like one of the major divides here is over this concept of Medicare for all. Where do the candidates break down on that?
Well, we have Bernie Sanders, who, as he keeps reminding us, wrote the damn bill, and Elizabeth Warren, who is a co-sponsor. And basically, of the candidates who were on the stage last night, those are the two main ones who are supporting Medicare for All. Everybody else, most notably Joe Biden, supports some way to expand coverage, but not to go quite as far as basically getting rid of the current system that the U.S. has and starting all over with a new one, which is effectively what Medicare for All would do.
Let's dig into what those options mean with the warning that the devil is in the details. When a candidate is talking about Medicare for All, what might that look like?
Well, what they say it would look like is that everybody would have Medicare, which is the popular health care program for seniors and some people with disabilities, except that's not really what it would be. It would be a whole new program that would be called Medicare that would be much more generous than current Medicare. Right now, if you're on the Medicare program, you probably have some kind of supplemental insurance. Either you can buy a plan that just pays the copayments and other out-of-pocket costs that come along with Medicare, or you can buy what's called a Medicare Advantage plan, which takes the place of some of the government payment systems and basically puts you in a managed care plan. But you have Medicaid if you're low income. There are a number of people who have both Medicare and Medicaid, but very few people have Medicare alone because in this day and age, it's just not all that generous. You are susceptible to having to pay potentially unlimited thousands of dollars in extra payments for Medicare. So the idea behind Medicare for All is that it would get rid of all those extra payments. What they say is that you wouldn't have to pay any premiums, any copayments, any deductibles, that everything would be free at the point of service, and it would be paid for by raising basically everybody's taxes and the rich people's taxes more.
Right, and that's one of the big knocks on it from critics of the Medicare for All idea. It sounds expensive. What if anything, do we know about how much it might cost?
Well, how much it might cost depends in very large part on how much you're going to pay health care providers. And since that hasn't been determined, it's really not possible to figure out how much Medicare for All would cost. There's, you know, all of these, well, if we pay them current Medicare rates, hospitals and doctors say that wouldn't be enough money for some of them to stay in business. So one would presume that they would pay them more than current Medicare rates. How much more? Hard to say. So how much would it cost? It depends. But certainly it would take a significant tax increase to pay for it if you're going to get rid of things like premiums and copayments and other out-of-pocket costs that patients now pay when they go seek health care.
Now, another option candidates are talking about is reviving the idea of a public option, which I dimly recall was in the early stages of the Affordable Care Act for like 30 seconds or something like that, and then it was dropped. Are we just bringing back the idea as it was initially proposed years ago?
Well, there are a lot of variations on what a public option would be. You remember correctly, it was part of the Affordable Care Act. It was part of the Affordable Care Act that passed the House, so it was there for more than 30 seconds. But it couldn't get 60 votes in the Senate. Joe Lieberman, the independent from Connecticut, rather famously said he wouldn't vote for the bill if it was in there, although it wasn't just Joe Lieberman. There were a couple of more conservative Democrats who did not want to have a public option. And this would have been simply a government-run plan that you could have signed up for instead of the private plans when you went to the insurance exchanges. So it wasn't really tied to Medicare. Now there are talks of a public option that would be actual Medicare, that people could buy into actual Medicare, or they could buy into a Medicare-like program. So there are different ways to do this. You could let people who have only people who buy their own insurance buy into this public option. You could let employers buy into the public option for their employees. You could, there's a couple of proposals where kids would start being enrolled in it, so you would sort of more gradually but also more certainly move everybody into a public plan by starting at childhood and then moving up. Or you could start at older ages and move down. So there's people who would be able to buy into Medicare at age 60 instead of 65 or even 50.
Talking to Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News about healthcare policy in the presidential race. That's a whirlwind tour of Democrats on healthcare. Julie, what is the latest from Republicans? There was the effort that came very close to succeeding in Congress to overturn the Affordable Care Act. There's still court action that could do it. What do we know from President Trump and other Republicans about what they would replace it with?
Well, the Republicans in Congress have not wanted to go back to this year, certainly not with the House in the hands of the Democrat. They didn't see any point in trying to take another run at repealing the Affordable Care Act. So the Republicans in Congress are mostly working, trying to figure out if they can do something about prescription drug prices or if they can do something about surprise medical bills, sort of smaller things that are still very important to voters. President Trump had been saying for months that he was going to unveil a new health plan, and it was going to be in 2 weeks, and that's been every 2 weeks since about April. Although this week there are reports that perhaps the administration isn't going to try to put together its own health plan, but perhaps they will put together some contingency plans for if the courts, as you mentioned, there is a lawsuit that could conceivably rule the entire Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. It's currently before a 3-judge appeals court in the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, and we're waiting for that decision now. Obviously, no matter how they decide, it will probably get appealed to the Supreme Court, and depending on when the appeals court decision comes down, we could have a Supreme Court decision on that in the middle of the campaign next June.
Right. And then we're starting from scratch. We're back to where we were, what, before 2008?
It could be a big mess. You know, it's the Affordable Care Act is much more than the things that we talk about, which tend to be these exchanges where people can buy their own health insurance and the Medicaid expansions. But there were a lot of big changes to the Medicare program in the Affordable Care Act. There were provisions for expensive biologic drugs to have generic copies made. There was an extension of the Indian Health Service. All of these things could potentially go away. They're talking about taking down the entire law. That could literally throw the healthcare system into chaos. And as of now, the Trump administration hasn't said what it would do if that were to happen.
And then, Julie, bringing us to the current day, we're seeing numbers out this week showing a decline in the number of the percentage of people currently covered under health coverage in the United States. What are we seeing there?
That's right. We're seeing almost 2 million more people without insurance in 2018 than the year before. A big chunk of that were fewer people on the Medicaid program for those with low incomes. The Trump administration has itself and many states have also made it more difficult for people to get Medicaid. Plus, there is this looming requirement called a public charge that would basically people who are here legally but not yet permanently, it would be counted against them if they use certain public programs, and Medicaid is one of them. So there is, and that's been sort of out there for a couple of years, which is why it may have shown up as one of the reasons in 2018 that there are fewer people on Medicaid.
In one way, Julie, this is the biggest issue in the presidential race, apparently, for Democrats. In another, a president can't really do that much on their own, right? How much focus should there be on getting presidential candidates, Republican and Democrat, to flesh out what they want to do with health care?
Well, of course, you know, as you mentioned, these are all things that would have to be done by Congress, but they would be done with presidential leadership. And this was something that President Obama made, you know, one of his top priorities. And there was a lot of presidential leadership in getting it done. President Bill Clinton also made it one of his top priorities, and he didn't get it done. So it doesn't happen without a president pushing it, but it doesn't necessarily happen even with a president pushing it.
And briefly, Julie, what would you like to hear from candidates that we're not hearing yet?
I would really like to hear more about things that are not just how would you pay for it and how much would it cost, because those are basically two things we can't know, but how they think about sort of the balance of public versus private, who should do what, who's really responsible for taking care of people who truly can't pay for health care, and how to ensure that that happens. There are a lot of other issues in the health care system that we're not hearing very much about. We haven't heard very much in the debates about women's reproductive health, for example. And again, we haven't really asked the Democratic candidates what they think should happen if the Affordable Care Act is struck down by the courts.
Julie, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
That's Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of KHN's What the Health podcast. We talked to her about the different Democratic visions for health care coming out of last night's candidate debate. Coming up, we'll talk with a local historian, a legendary historian, featured in the upcoming Ken Burns documentary on country music. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Madison residents are weighing in on the prospect of F-35 fighter jets being stationed in the city. We'll find out more about the debate during our state news roundup. Now, documentary filmmaker Ken Burns is out with a new project this week exploring the history of country music. The 8-part series premieres this Sunday at 7 p.m. on Wisconsin Public Television. If you tune in, one of the featured historians you'll see is longtime Wisconsin resident Bill Malone. He's the author of the book Country Music USA. He also hosts the weekly radio program Back to the Country on WORT in Madison. He's a professor emeritus at Tulane University. Bill, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, Bill, country music has been such a huge part of your life, your research. What do you love about it, and what got you started on this path?
Well, it's the music of my life and my family. I've been a fan all my life. You know, country music itself is dates from the 1920s when homegrown music began to be commercialized by radio and recording. And I was born about 11 years later, 1934. So my whole life is almost covered the span of country music. And the first music I heard was the song sung by my mother. You know, she sang old gospel songs and country songs like I'll Be All Smiles Tonight and The Little Rosewood Casket and The Letter Etched in Black, something like that. Then we got our first battery radio in 1939. I started hearing what I would call radio hillbillies at that time, you know, coming out of Dallas and Fort Worth and Shreveport, and then from Nashville through the Grand Ole Opry. So it's just been part of my life always. And I listened to it and thought about it and sang it. And finally, I got the opportunity to write on it when I was in graduate school. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the subject, and that became Country Music USA. So I really can't separate the music from my life. I associate it with my mother and those early radio experiences. And that's, to me, that's the great thing about the Ken Burns documentary. It sort of validates the music, and it validates the culture I grew up in, and it validates the work that I've been involved in for over 50 years, first with the dissertation and later with the book.
Yeah, with your writing, your teaching, your radio show, you really bring us back to the history from the very beginnings of country music. Why is it important for us in 2019 to be in touch with the roots and the history of country music?
Well, I think this documentary is coming at a very crucial time, a very appropriate time. It's no secret to anybody that as a nation, we're in crisis, you know, with such a polarized society and so many anxieties. And I think it's important for people to remember that there's something good in our society. There's a music that has drawn upon many cultural resources of the United States, and music that documents the life and experiences of a major segment of the American public. So I think country music can be a real relief and a real purgative to what's going on now.
Well, we see in country music nowadays, there's questions of the performer Lil Nas X. People talking about, can African-Americans be part of country music? There are questions about, women's role in country music. But they've always been there, right?
Yeah. The women were not always that prominent in the early years of country music, but they were there. Virtually all of the important country musicians talk about the role that their mothers played in their lives, teaching them how to play an instrument or teaching them how to sing harmony. And then, of course, I think always it'd be kind of hard to document this, but I sort of suspect that the basic audience for country music has always been women, because they were the ones who were at home listening to the radio, looking for some way to relieve themselves from their anxieties and the lonely work that they had to do. And same thing was true with African Americans. Of course, there were some performers who were present. The most important would be D. Ford Bailey, the harmonica player, who was on the early broadcast of the Grand Ole Opry out of Nashville. And black musicians performed generally behind the scenes, but just one performer after another can testify to the role that African Americans have played in their lives in music. Uncle Dave Macon in the 1920s did a lot of songs that came out of the blackface minstrel tradition. Jimmy Rogers, the first great star of the music, and the fellow who's considered to be the father of country music now, he borrowed heavily from black railroad workers who worked on his father's section gang. And there, as Rogers was growing up in Mississippi, he heard this music not only in the flesh from street musicians and the like, but he also heard the people on phonograph recordings. And then this is a long string, you know, Bob Wills in the 1930s drew heavily from people like Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong to create what we now call Western Swing. Hank Williams learned from a street singer in Alabama named Rufus Payne, or T-Tot was what they usually called him. His real name was Rufus Payne. And, of course, then Elvis, it's just on and on. There's just so many examples of white musicians who borrowed from black sources. The same thing was true of Bill Monroe, you know, the creator of bluegrass music. One of his early influences was a guitar player there in Western Kentucky named Arnold Schultz. So it's just an easily documented part of country music's history and its origins.
Now, Bill, I've talked to multiple people in Wisconsin who have said, I didn't like country music. I didn't think I liked country music till I started listening to Bill Malone's show on the radio, and that brought me into it. What do you say to people who say, I'm not really a country music person? How do you bring them into the fold?
Well, I just tell them to listen to it. this story has been told a lot, but I think it's very suggestive. According to the jazz critic Nat Hentoff, Charlie Parker, the great progressive jazz musician, used to go into a bar in New York City, and he would put nickel after nickel into the jukebox, right back when you could use nickels in the jukebox, and he would listen to what was then called hillbilly music. That's the earlier term for country music. And his friend said to Charlie, Charlie, how can you listen to that stuff? And Charlie said, well, listen to the stories, man. Listen to the stories. So I think that's part of it. I think the country music really documents American history in a sense, but above all, it really brings out the feelings that people have. It speaks to their desires or anguish, their fears, their frustrations. Unfortunately, sometimes it speaks to their prejudices. And it's in a form that people can relate to. The musics, I mean, the melodies are easily hummable. You can sing along very easily. The words are very descriptive. And just overall, it's a music that the average person can really relate to.
Can you give us, before we wrap up, Bill, a taste of this Ken Burns documentary? What are we going to see and hear?
Well, it's amazing the material they've come up with. I'm really admire the Ken Burns team. They've gone out and they've found very rare photographs. They found home movies and a lot of them film footage that was taken at festivals by interested fans who took their equipment with them and documented the music. And so it's just really well detailed and documented body of music, and it covers just about every angle of the music's history over the years, from the early days when the music was emerging from its folk roots, when it was first being commercialized, and then when it began to take off with great influential performers like Bob Wills and Eddie Arnold and Hank Williams and on. And just marvelous footage, and the music is constant. For obvious reasons, there's more music in this documentary than you find in most Ken Burns documentaries. Of course, the jazz is full of music, but country music is different. In order to tell the story, you've got to have songs that tell a story. And so the music is not only there, but it's very lyric-oriented, and it tells the history of the music and also a good slice of the history of the country.
Bill, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for talking to me.
Bill Malone is the author of Country Music USA. He also hosts the weekly radio program Back to the Country on WORT Radio in Madison, professor emeritus at Tulane University. He's a featured historian in the new Ken Burns documentary Country Music. It premieres this Sunday at 7 on Wisconsin Public Television. We'll go out on one of Bill's favorite childhood songs, I'll Be All Smiles Tonight by the Carter Family.
Hard is life, though my heart may break tomorrow. Be all smiles tonight. I'll be all smiles tonight, love. I'll be all smiles tonight. Though my heart may break tomorrow.
It's the home stretch for the baseball season, and the Brewers are in the running for a playoff spot with lots of drama. Producer Bill Martins is tracking it closely.
Hey there.
What's going on, Bill?
Okay, so a week ago, the Brewers were five games out of the final playoff spot in the National League.
The wild card spot.
The wild card, exactly. The second wild card spot. Mm-hmm. There's two of them. Since then, they've rattled off seven wins in a row, and the teams who they needed to get past struggled a bit. Now, all of a sudden, going into this weekend, the Brewers are tied for that final wild card spot. So they're back in it.
Okay, a big series this weekend. Who are they up against?
They're on the road against the Cardinals, the division-leading St. Louis Cardinals. The Brewers are four games behind them. It's a lot to ask, but if the Brewers can sweep, they go into Monday just being one game back with about 2 weeks left to go in the season.
Okay, whoops. This is a series where you really want all your star players ready to rock.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. People know, this is some bad news here.
Right. Christian Yelich had a season-ending knee injury a couple of days ago. He's out for the rest of the season. I heard he could come back for the World Series if they get to that point. Probably not likely. But the Brewers have had other guys on their team who have stepped up in a couple of games since he's been gone. If they can keep that going, there's reason to be optimistic here.
And they're neck and neck for this wild card spot with?
With the Cubs.
The Cubs.
Actually, Central Time producer Tim Peterson's Chicago Cubs.
Whoop. Sorry, Tim. We got to root against you, man.
Yep.
Sorry about the Bears, too. This is Central Time. Thanks, Bill. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.